SpaceX expands to Louisiana, and NASA tests its new moon suits. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. SpaceX is looking to expand into Louisiana for a new launch facility with multiple launch pads for its Starship spacecraft.
I mean, if you think about it, they're talking about, you know, up to 30 launches a day. That's mind-boggling.
We'll hear from space industry expert Dale Ketchum about what this means for SpaceX and Louisiana and how this expansion could change the space industry. Then, to walk on the moon, NASA needs new suits.
The suit has got to be capable of, you know, a wide range of thermal capabilities.
We'll speak with NASA's Mike Snyder about the new EVA suit for future Artemis crews and how the agency is testing them. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Before we get to the show, an update on a mission we've talked about before on this show. NASA's Roman Space Telescope successfully launched from the Kennedy Space Center Sunday on a mission to study some of the mysteries in our universe. The telescope will take about 3 months to get to its planned spot, about a million miles from Earth. It's going to study exoplanets and search for cosmic mysteries like dark matter and dark energy. NASA expects the first images from the telescope by the end of the year. SpaceX wants to build a new spaceport in Louisiana. The company wants to start construction as early as next year and launch Starship, its giant rocket, from the new location. SpaceX says it plans to invest $100 billion into the spaceport and create over 3,000 jobs in Louisiana. But how will this impact the locals there and their environment? And what will this new location do for the future of SpaceX? Here to answer those questions and talk more about the company's plans is Dale Ketchum, a space industry expert and former vice president at the state agency Space Florida. Dale, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Glad to be here.
So Dale, let's talk about this this project in Louisiana. What's the need? Why does SpaceX need another launch facility?
Well, it's not just another launch facility. It is a massive new launch facility. 10 to 12 launch pads for Starship, that is huge. Based upon what I have heard from SpaceX, my guess is this will not be the last one. Their intention is to provide the capability for massive launch into space, the ability to put many, many tons regularly into space. I mean, if you think about it, they're talking about, you know, up to 30 launches a day. That's mind-boggling. I'm still somewhat bewildered as to what is 30 launches of a Starship is 3,000 tons a day. I don't know what 3,000 tons of what is going into space. But I think it's a reflection of SpaceX, you know, especially in America, we're taught to dream big, and no one dreams as big as SpaceX. And, you know, their enduring credit, no one comes as close to fulfilling those dreams as they do. They're far from perfect, but they are almost always impressive. So I think this is just another step in their participation in the grand space enterprise.
The 30 launches a day is also mind-boggling to me as well. So I'm glad the two of us share that shared
bewilderment.
Yes, bewilderment. Yes. Do you think that this may be an instance of, if you build it, a need will come kind of thing, much like SpaceX did early on in the days of Falcon 9?
My guess is a lot of it is driven by space-based data centers, which I think in many ways we would all like to see happen because we're all increasingly relying on AI and increased technology and bandwidth and all that other good stuff. And that needs to be supported by infrastructure. And it's problematic building more and more and more of them down here. But I still have yet to see convincing evidence that you can put data centers in space and protect them from the nasty stuff that's out there, solar storms and even more menacing weird stuff coming out of deep space. But again, maybe they can solve that problem. And that I think that's the biggest thing they're talking about right now, at least publicly.
Louisiana, kind of out of left field. Why didn't SpaceX decide to expand? And I know that this is speculation, of course. Why would you think that they would not expand in Florida or in Texas? Why a brand new launch facility, and why Louisiana?
Primarily because we don't have room for 12 Starship launch sites.
We being Florida, right?
Yes. I mean, we could dredge and fill the Cape Canaveral National Seashore and run pads up Volusia County, which is what they had originally conceived of in the early development of the Apollo program. But if they did that, you would also find me on the street protesting that move. We are constrained here in Florida. We don't have 12 launch sites. But additionally, one of the advantages of Louisiana in particular, it's a clear launch site going south for polar orbits. And I'm sure a huge factor in this was the ready availability of natural gas, because we're already stretched for how we're going to provide natural gas as fuel for the Cape as the launch cadence builds up, not just for SpaceX, but also for Blue and Relativity and everybody else who's transitioning to that fuel source. But, you know, Space Florida has been working on that for a long time. And I know both NASA and Space Force have put out some, I believe there were RFIs, requests for information on how we could establish a natural gas processing capability on the Cape to support those launch activities. You know, one of the bigger issues, if not the biggest issue, is how do you get it here? Because if it's trucked, which is what we do now, given what's projected in the years ahead, you're talking about 1,000 trucks a day, maybe many more. And no one wants that, especially the people who are responsible for maintaining roads and bridges, because big trucks like that beat the tar out of your infrastructure, and replacing roads and bridges is not cheap. I think Louisiana, that helps out there, having ready availability to that level of natural gas. But also, you know, if you're familiar with Louisiana, it's a lot like Texas. They are a state that has grown and been built in no small measure more by the big oil than any other industry. They both, I think, regretfully, at least from my perspective, don't have a particularly stellar environmental protection reputation. It's a state that's used to that. I think in large measure, that's one of the reasons why the Louisiana is losing the coastline as readily as it is, which is its primary defense against hurricanes, is because of all the canals that they've drilled through the wetlands and the delta there to support the oil and gas industry. Now, ostensibly, as I understand it, SpaceX is commendably talking about what it's going to do to restore a lot of that coastline. And I hope they do. That's a big investment. And I'm assuming that a big chunk of that $100 billion tab that they're associating with it, that SpaceX is going to spend, a lot of that is going to be environmental restoration. I hope so.
Why is the natural gas important? It's not used as rocket fuel, right?
It is.
Oh, it is.
It is. That's what Starship and Blue Origin and Relativity and Vulcan, they're all going to natural gas because it is a superior fuel for restarting your engines. It's better than the rocket fuel of the past, which is what Falcon 9 runs on.
And it's great to cook on, too. I love a gas stove.
It is.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Dale Ketchum about SpaceX's new plans to build a spaceport in Louisiana. There's a lot that is happening with transforming this this region in Louisiana. As you've already outlined some of the challenges there, but there are certainly going to be regulatory challenges when it comes to this, and also challenges to winning over the public. Walk me through the path forward for SpaceX. Just how difficult is this going to be to make this happen?
Well, my guess is in large measure it's going to be a little bit like it was in Brownsville, where you have a particularly, it's not a very wealthy part of the state. It's beautiful. I mean, they have great hunting and fishing, and a lot of people live there who've been there for many, many generations. But, you know, the big, obviously the elected officials and the people who get paid to grow the industry in Louisiana are very excited about this. But additionally, it's been interesting that this has been in many ways telegraphed that this was coming, because a couple of months ago, Governor Landry signed a piece of legislation that caught people's attention because it stayed law now. I don't want to be too technical here, but I think basically it disallows anyone from suing a space-based company for a variety of different infractions, which was interesting popping up in Louisiana because they're not really noted for that. And then you had the federal government passing, coming out with the recent space transportation policy, the FAA moving to exempt new commercial space launch activity from most environmental regulation. That's going to be really handy in Louisiana. And the Department of Defense talking about the need for, 1,000 launches a year. Department of Defense, Space Force in particular, they're now in the commercial business. They pay somebody to put their payload into orbit and turn it on, make sure it works, and then they pay them. They don't really care where it's coming from as long as it's from the United States. So all of these things have been building to set a regulatory framework where I'm sure it's purely coincidence. This is going to make things in Louisiana move much more smoothly.
Do you think this is actually going to happen? Is SpaceX going to be able to pull this off in Louisiana? 30 launches a day, that's wild. Can they do it?
I think like most, there's a significant degree of skepticism simply because of the breadth and scale of what's being proposed. But by the same token, if anybody on this planet can do it, we know it's SpaceX. It's also the case that Elon is great for announcing he's going to do something in a certain time at a certain price, and it ends up costing more and being delayed. But in my industry, compared to what NASA says it's going to do and the time and cost, he's immensely more efficient and fast. You know, it may not end up being 12 launch pads. It may be only 4. I think it will happen. I think it can be done well. I think in terms of growing that community, my first thought was Vermilion Parish, which is where it's going. It's going to be hard for them to recruit families to come to Vermilion Parish because they've had their challenge bringing workforce and talent to Brownsville because it wasn't particularly attractive, especially when we're recruiting people out of Los Angeles, which has, shall we say, a more fun nightlife. But Vermilion Parish, I did a little homework. Evidently, they've got a pretty good school system there. It's small. It's only about 9,000 kids. But I think it's a great opportunity for SpaceX to take an even larger role in developing their school system because they're going to need it to not just recruit, but retain the talent they're going to need if they're going to accomplish what they hope to. Now, will they get involved in the way that they could and should, in my opinion? To be determined. I don't know. Is there pushback from locals? Absolutely. But then that's appropriate. It's like when, every now and then over here on the Cape, we get pushback from environmentalists. Competing interests, fighting it out is how you supposedly are supposed to come up with the best solution. This is just another step in the evolution of a much grander space enterprise. Louisiana can and should learn from the Cape and from Brownsville, but none of us are finished. As a commercial space industry matures here and across the country, we have to keep growing together if this is to be sustainable. Industry has its focus, as it should, but the communities that host this work must make sure that they benefit from it as well. It's like a marriage. I'm almost 40 years into my own, nothing but bliss. So I know how a healthy relationship demands a give and take. You don't always get exactly what you want, but if you do it right, you can both look back and realize how fortunate you've been. I want that for the grand exploration of space, but I also want it for my home state of Florida and for every state. It's been said we go to space for the good of humanity. That needs to be constantly demonstrated here as we go forward.
Certainly interesting to watch over the next few years, and we will certainly be reaching back out to you for analysis and commentary on it. Dale Ketchum, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brendan.
That was Dale Ketchum, a space industry expert and retired vice president at the state agency Space Florida. Still to come, how do you test a spacesuit? A look at building and testing NASA's new moon suits. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. If NASA wants to put humans on the moon once again, it's going to need some new gear. The future Artemis spacesuits need to be able to withstand the moon's harsh environment, like extreme temperatures, and they'll need to allow astronauts to move easily and, most importantly, breathe. But we can't just hop on over to the moon and test these suits out. So how does NASA test them here on Earth to prepare for those future moon missions? We're here to talk more about these new spacesuits is Mike Snyder. He's a test manager with NASA's Integrated Test Facilities with the XEVA Systems Project. Mike, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much.
I'm so excited to talk with you about testing these Artemis spacesuits. But before we get into the kind of the nitty-gritty of that, I want to talk about the suit itself, because these are extremely complicated pieces of equipment, right? What is the purpose of these suits?
The suits are used for EVA, which is, you know, at NASA, we like our acronyms. So EVA stands for extravehicular activity. So a suit is required for when going out into the vacuum of space or any kind of non-Earth environment, I guess you could say, that will protect you from said environment. And so EVA is just really a fancy name for spacewalk or moonwalk in this particular case.
We've developed spacewalking suits and moonwalking suits. Why the need for new ones?
Well, the ones that we currently have and that we're using on ISS are, you know, they're getting up there in age. And we're also leveraging our commercial capabilities and our commercial partners. For example, the ones that are on ISS today were actually used during the shuttle program as well, and were used in the construction of the ISS. Those were never really meant for anything beyond low Earth orbit or those type of things, so a new generation of suits is required.
Tell me a bit about your job, because it sounds really cool, a spacesuit tester, right?
Right. So like with any new hardware, and particularly with space hardware, we start off with this process that's called DDT&E, or it stands for Design, Development, Test, and Evaluation. And so we'll be doing, and what we have been doing, is development testing, meaning what can we learn about the suit? How can we make it better? How can we make sure that it's going to be the best thing that can serve us? And we take those lessons learned from these development tests and we apply them to the final design of the suit. And then we begin to pivot from a DDT&E design test and evaluation to the verification process. And that's where your engineering is really solid. You've got the majority of what is going to be in the design of the suit, and you begin a qualification program, meaning that the suit that you've designed is really up to the task for which it was designed for.
The lunar environment, it sounds extremely harsh and completely unwelcoming. You know, what do you have to take into account when you are, you know, designing and testing? What are some of the things that you're looking for that this needs to hold up against?
Well, certainly it needs to provide the pressure. Right. Mm-hmm. And a living environment to keep the occupant alive and healthy. So obviously, air, thermal control, everything that you're going to need to try to remain relatively comfortable and everything like that. For the environment that which it sees, for example, you could see just over your shoulder, mm-hmm. a 250-ish degree temperature on this side and a minus 250 degree temperature environment just over your shoulder. So the suit has got to be capable of, you know, a wide range of thermal capabilities, as well as particularly with the lunar surface, you have the challenge of the lunar regolith. Lunar regolith is just a fancy term for moon dirt. And but it's very fine. It's not like you're conventional dirt that you might have in your yard. And so there's things that we've got to do to make sure, and mitigations that we've got to do to make sure it doesn't get into the bearings or minimize to into the bearings so that it doesn't seize those up and the astronauts inside still have the ability to move.
How do you do that, Mike? Do you take pieces of the spacesuit or the entire spacesuit and just like hit it with a blowtorch or put it in a freezer or just throw sharp dirt at it? How do you actually test it?
Well, and that all rolls back into what I was talking about with not only the development test, but certainly with verification testing and qualification testing. These suits have to meet a certain set of requirements. And so as part of that process where we buy down and burn off those requirements, meaning we've run the appropriate tests, the analyses, whatever you might be, in order to say, yes, we have satisfied those requirements, and that suit is now qualified in there. So some of the things that we'll do is not only mobility, but thermal vac testing, thermal vacuum chamber. Mm-hmm. There is obviously a limitation, and we can simulate what we know of the lunar surface, and we can make that regolith in a lab and do certain testing and everything like that associated with it. At the end of the day, we are limited because obviously we're going to be testing in an environment here on Earth. And there are certain things and certain facilities that we have that can mimic to the best of our ability, the lunar or the environment that it's going to see. But nothing is absolute 100%.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Mike Snyder, a test manager with NASA's Integrated Test Facilities on the XEVA Systems Project. We're talking about new suits and how NASA tests them here on Earth. You're saying no flamethrower or blowtorch is involved in this, Mike?
Well, the thermal vac chamber might be. It's certainly less and stop short of a blowtorch, but it will see that that thermal environment that I was mentioning a few minutes ago.
Certainly gets rather hot in there, I'm sure. Along with protecting the astronauts, they have to be able to move in this thing as well. How do you test mobility of a spacesuit like this?
Those are a number of test campaigns that we've run in the last couple of years where we assess said mobility. But we do have certain facilities that we use that can mimic the lunar or partial G environment. And we do have crew that we put in there or test subjects that we put in there. And we ask them to do a variety of tasks to assess that mobility and how well can you move. And like I said, there's a couple of facilities, some of them, you may have heard of this giant pool, if you will, called the Neutral Buoyancy Lab. Mm-hmm. We're getting ready to run a number of tests in there now. We've also got a facility called Argos. So you're literally have like this robot and this rafters up there, and it is compensating for your weight, and it's putting you in a lunar offload environment. And so we practice task and mobility assessments in there with basically with every test we run. There's a series of other facilities that we have. One is called AXES, and it stands for third generation system. So it's kind of like the son of Argos. And with Argos, we can only do one suit at a time. With AXES, we'll be able to do multiple suits. MBL, we can do multiple suits. And there's pros and cons with each in trying to simulate that lunar environment. But, it gets us what we need.
You mentioned test subjects. Have you yourself been in this suit?
I have not been in the suit as a test subject. The test subjects usually we go through a process in selecting them. They have to meet a number of criteria. Obviously, we try to use crew as test subjects as much as we possibly can, just given the fact that they, at the end of the day, will be the operators of the system.
Is it because of your beard? And listeners cannot see right now, but you have a magnificent beard. I assume that is why you can't get in the suit, right?
That's absolutely right.
That's it. Yeah, I did want to ask you about the crew, because I do know throughout the history of NASA, crew has been very involved in developing hardware, especially with Artemis. We heard a lot from the Artemis II crew about that. The folks that could be flying on Artemis Four and beyond, what role are they playing in the design and development and testing of this suit?
Well, with respect to the crew for Artemis 4 and 5, we don't obviously know who they are yet. They haven't been formally selected, but we routinely have a number of astronauts across various physical characteristics, sizes and everything like that, because we want to try to get the full spectrum of what person can do in the suit, whether they be a shorter person or a taller person. And the crew office certainly helps doing that. And not only from getting a jump on any potential training objectives, but their feedback. A lot of them have obviously been in suits before and have maybe had the opportunity to do an EVA on ISS or someplace like that. So their feedback, their firsthand experience is absolutely critical.
Mike, you know, this is, as we talked about at the start of this program, it's an incredibly complex piece of hardware you're developing to keep astronauts alive in a harsh environment that humans should not be in without having some sort of protection like this. That has got to be an enormous responsibility that falls on you and your colleagues. How do you go about knowing this, the safety of these astronauts is in your hands?
Well, it's something that we consider and take into account and hold very personally, obviously, every day in everything that we do. Safety of not only the crew, but in this particular case, whoever is in the suit, if it's not a crew member, you know, safety is first and paramount. And we have a series of checks and balances, if you will, to make sure that when we do this and we do it, we do it and under the safest possible conditions that we can possibly do. But it is a thing that, you know, we take very seriously here at NASA. And yeah, it's something that I've been around for a number of years now. And so just like many others, and well, everybody else, it's something that we hold very dear to our hearts.
And finally, Mike, have you been thinking about that moment when those suits fly and those astronauts step down that ladder and plant their foot into that lunar regolith and you know that that's your suit that you helped work on?
Yeah, I absolutely have. I would bet there's not anybody in the entire Artemis program that hasn't thought about that moment. And when we see those boots on the ground or that lander touchdown or, you know, that SLS fly, that Orion heading out to lunar orbit. Absolutely. It's something that we always think about, that somehow, some way, you know, we had a hand in making this possible.
And maybe the next version of the suit will accommodate us bearded fellas if we want to go to the moon, right?
Absolutely.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my absolute pleasure.
That was Mike Snyder, test manager with NASA's Integrated Test Facility with the XEVA Systems Project. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook at @AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you think you might make a good guest, we'll reach out. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marian Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.